Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I have a special show for you today, an interview with one of Alaska's most remarkable and interesting outdoor adventurers, Roman Dial. Roman has been with us before, but this time I sat down with him for a full hour to talk about his life, and the conversation got pretty deep, from his youth when he showed up in Alaska and immediately began doing risky and exciting things, to the more recent tragedy when his son disappeared in Costa Rica while pursuing a similar life of exploration and adventure. Roman talked about the odyssey of trying to find his son and how that struggle was exploited and twisted by a reality TV show he turned to for help. And we'll also get into many other tales, including how Roman Dial helped start wilderness racing and helped develop the packraft as a tool for Alaska travel. Please stay tuned. Well, today I wanted to spend some time with an old friend, Roman Dial, who is very well known in the outdoor community in Alaska. That might be an understatement, actually, because Roman has been around kind of forever and has done kind of everything, and was one of his many claims to fame as being a founder of the wilderness races that we have in Alaska. And he was on the ground floor of creating pack rafts and doing all kinds of stuff. And he's also kind of world famous because of all the reality shows and the race shows and all the different media he's done. And then Roman also has a side of himself that many Alaskans might not know. As a professor of biology and mathematics at APU, he's done some really interesting research. And I thought it would be fun and interesting just to sit down with Roman and talk about his life and his work and just some of the adventures that he's had. And so that's why I am bringing him in here today. And thanks for being here, Roman.
Oh, well, I'm really flattered, Charles. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, not at all. So I remember talking once about the story about how you came to Alaska, and I thought it was one of the wildest, woolliest stories of Alaska arrival that I had ever heard. And I thought, wow, that's not something that I would want my kids to do. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, I'm not sure. I have to wait and hear.
Well, didn't you like come up here as a sort of unaccompanied teenager or something back in the day?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, but my first trip to Alaska, though, I was a little kid. I was 9 years old, and I came up in 1970 because I had a couple of uncles who were working at the Usabelli coal mine operating heavy equipment. This was 1970 before they'd finished the road from Anchorage to Fairbanks. Uh-huh. And and I came up for the summer, and then I came up again like a couple years later to Ketchikan, where my uncle Zinn was living in a tent out by Ward Lake, where while he worked as an electrician in town. And me and my best friend then came up and we went fly fishing every day, all day, for like 3 weeks, and you know, in the rainforest streams. And then I came up during the height of the pipeline construction in 1975, when I was probably 14, and that's the thing that I, like, God, if my kids ever did that, I would have just, like, exploded.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. And that was the sort of the wild days of Alaska,
too,
sort of gold rush days.
Oh, yeah, and I hitchhiked around the state. I was 14, and I hitchhiked around the state and tried to get up on the Harding Ice Field before that they'd built that bridge over the Resurrection River there, and got swept downstream and had to throw my pack off of a cliff, and you know, just a bunch of terrible things kind of happened to me on that trip.
But you were having a great time.
I did, yeah. I mean, you know, I learned a lot, you know. What do they say, like, experience, what is it, like, good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment?
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of experience.
Very quickly, yeah.
Yeah, but then when I finally came up here, you know, I came up to go to college in Fairbanks, and I was, you know, because it was the only place I really wanted to go, because I'd had all these great adventures.
When did you first kind of fall in love with wilderness and adventuring and all the stuff that ended up defining a lot of your life?
You know, I think it was when I was like 7 or 8 or 9. I lived in Seattle, and my grandmother had a farm south of Olympia, and I would go there on the weekends and go out in the woods there in the farmland with my uncles. I had one uncle in particular, Brian, who was like exactly 9 years older than me, and he and I would go out hunting, you know, for little birds and stuff, and he'd make me taste whatever I shot. He'd say, "You got to eat whatever you kill," so I tasted a lot of birds.
Weird little birds, huh?
Yeah, but anyway, I think that's when it happened, you know, because I was sort of interested in nature. All kids are interested in nature, you know, uh-huh. by being human. And but if you don't, if you live in a city, you're kind of starved of it a bit. And then if you get to go have a, you know, a taste of it every weekend, then you get hooked on it. I got hooked at an early age. And then, you know, I grew up kind of at the time when National Geographic was showing TV shows about the National Outdoor Leadership School and Outward Bound. And, mm-hmm. you know, we had National Geographic, and it was kind of when the rise of popularity of nature.
It's kind of a cool thing at the time. Yeah,
yeah, it was a cool thing. And so I think I got hooked. And then I'd been to Alaska, and that was the wildest place, especially compared to like Seattle or suburban Virginia where I went to high school. So
yeah.
As soon as I could, I came up.
The romance catches you, and I kind of guess this probably happened to you when you realize, like, if you walk that direction, you're never going to hit anything, right? I mean,
yeah.
that's part of it. When you're coming, especially coming from the lower 48, where that really doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. Yeah, I mean, you walk for an hour, and you come to another road or a fence
right.
or a farm. Yeah, and here you don't. So, yeah, and then I think the very first fall that I moved up here, I was 16, and I was trying to do something every weekend when I was going to UAF. And one of the first things I did was to, I hitchhiked down to Denali and took the bus in and got off at Eielson and then walked up along the Muldrow and over Anderson Pass and then out
wow.
to the highway at the Igloo. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
And as a beginner, it's a pretty impressive trip.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people use pack raft these days and have an adventure on it.
Mm-hmm. So you were 16 when you started college?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just a precocious kid, didn't want us to hang around high school and...
Yeah, you know, I started school young and I skipped a grade and it was a mistake. You know, like I was too immature for my age and sort of socially kind of backward.
Uh-huh.
Still am.
seemed like you're doing okay to me. But so how did you develop? I'm always interested in talking to people about how you developed your outdoor skills and, you know, to what extent you learned them and to what extent you just had to make a ton of mistakes. I think that a lot of people... You know, even here in Alaska, are nervous about really doing big outdoor adventures and don't know, like, well, how do I learn? Or they're embarrassed of not knowing stuff. And, you know, nobody starts knowing anything, right? I mean, you all have to learn it at some point.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, we're born with some judgment that we don't even realize we have. Like, my feeling is that we're all born with fear to protect ourselves. So, mm-hmm. like, little kids are afraid of the dark. It's a good thing to be afraid of. All of us at some point are afraid of the water, we're afraid of the cold, we're afraid of loud noises, we're afraid of big animals, we're afraid of little spiders and snakes. These are all fears that were sort of, that are built in and they're a default. And part of growing up is learning to overcome those fears. And then you can actually get kind of addicted to like scaring yourself but surviving, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And but like how I learned, I think, is that, you know, I've been fortunate to have a lot of people that I've met and been mentored by. And then I often feel like, oh, that's an interesting thing. Why don't we try this? Sort of somebody brings me to the edge of something and I can see beyond. You know, like if something's happening, there's different kinds of people. Like if there's something dramatic happening, one person points it out. And there's a lot of people who run up and get right behind that person and look at whatever drama is happening, but there's other people who kind of go beyond that first person
mm-hmm.
and want to get closer and see, and they take a risk by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe I'm one of those people who go up to, like, Dick Griffith showed me the pack raft and I'm like, wow, this is great, but I went a little bit farther than Dick.
Uh-huh.
And now, you know, there's people going farther than I went, and so that's kind of how those things go. So I think that you know, my wife, on the other hand, she's game to try anything. Well, not really, but not anything. But she's not necessarily going to be one to, like, jump into the water
mm-hmm.
that nobody's jumped into.
She's not going to be the first one to try it. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Well, part of this adventuring thing that I think is really maybe uniquely Alaskan, and I sense in you, is this desire to do something that you don't know the outcome.
For sure.
So
yeah.
So I mean, when we think about a lot of kind of float trips or backpacking trips that people might take on a trail with a guide, etc., a lot of the setting up of those trips and the sort of progression of those trips is removing the element of the unknown, where sort of true adventure, sort of the nature of it, and I think a lot of Americans kind of don't get this anymore, it's only an adventure if you don't know how it's going to come out. You know, if you've got to really do something to make it come out the way it needs to come out, you know? And would you agree with that? I mean, is that sort of the attraction?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think that it's a sort of a sense of discovery that that I enjoy a lot. And so I don't really like following trails, like human trails, very much. Now, I still, if I'm going someplace new, I'll do a lot of research. I like guidebooks, but I like to look in between the guidebook routes. And then, and I don't, to get back to trails, I mean, like ATV trails are sort of interesting to walk on because you never really know where they're going to go. And but I don't really like ATV trails. And sure, I've walked on the Resurrection Pass Trail and all the trails around South Central, but I really like following animal trails the most because you really have to be paying attention at all times. They're kind of easy to find, but they're hard to hold, you know, mm-hmm. so you can bump into them and you're like, wow, what a great trail. And then where'd it go?
Disappears, right.
Exactly, disappears. And so for me, just having to stay kind of focused and alert and discovering where it goes, to me, that kind of encapsulates the adventure of wilderness travel.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure, like when I was younger, you know, climbing mountains and going up a route that hadn't been climbed or even one that had been climbed, but you know, in the mountains, the conditions change. It can be very difficult mm-hmm. and success is never guaranteed. That was an important part, was like, you know, can it be done? Can I do it? Same with whitewater, running whitewater. But those things have such an element of danger and hazard to them. Mm-hmm. And as I've gotten older, I don't really need that kind of, you know, adrenalized jolt of discovery. I'm fine with finding where an animal trail goes.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about this about with Adrian Lindholm, who just wrote a book about her development as an Alaska outdoors woman. And mm-hmm. And she was talking about when she first got here, this need not to ask anybody how to do anything and to sort of act like she knew everything and sort of doing the gnarliest possible trip to show that you could do it, you know, and kind of putting a feather in your cap to some extent. Mm-hmm. And then growing a little bit and realizing that's kind of an empty, you know, reason for doing some of this stuff and maturing into other reasons for doing it. I wonder if you felt the same progression in your life.
Well, I still like putting feathers in my cap,
all right.
You know, but I don't do it just for that. I mean, I certainly mm-hmm. have, but a lot of the things that I found really satisfying, people didn't even really get when I started doing them. You know, I remember being in Fairbanks and telling people, wow, you like the Brooks Range? A pack raft makes the Brooks Range. Everything you like about the Brooks Range, you're going to like even more with a pack raft. And nobody got one. You know, they're like, no, I'm going to stick with my Klepper. And why mm-hmm. would you? I'd rather just go hiking or boating. Why would you want to do both? And then, you know, now that's one that's kind of obviously big.
Yeah.
And then, you know, for a while in the 80s, which is like 30 years ago now, mm-hmm. I was riding mountain bikes across wilderness areas of Alaska, you know, and and people were like, well, why would you want to, you know, why don't you just go hiking or why don't you just keep your bike on the road? And now, you know, that's become rather popular too.
Yeah.
And so I guess those things, I wasn't doing those like, hey, look at me, look at this, because nobody gave a damn.
Right.
You know, in fact, they kind of like, I don't know. They kind of
thought you were a little weird.
They ostracized me. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. The conventional, because really, you know, we're talking about social communities. And if you're, the social community is sort of like a bell curve and everybody's kind of squarely underneath of the top of the curve. And if you're a person out there on the tails, you know, you're out on the tails and you're kind of like a weirdo, like you said.
Yeah.
But what happens is it's the weirdos who end up kind of pulling the curve that way.
They're the ones with the new ideas, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're so, sort of like the mutating genes that everybody is going to follow, you know.
Right, if it's a successful gene.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Otherwise, they don't go that way.
Yeah.
But for sure. And then there are some other things that I did mostly because they were, I don't know, it was sort of it's a form of creativity. Like you imagine something and then you can bring it to life. Like you were telling me about your kids who all sound very creative and artistic. And I'm sure that it's similar for them to conceive of something and then make it into something. And here, you know, I would conceive of a route or a way to do it. And it's not a piece of art that I can mm-hmm. kind of handle or show anybody. But I didn't do it to show other people. I did it for myself.
I think that's part of this sort of the basic Alaska impulse is sort of this idea of like, we're out there, we don't have to follow a road, we don't have to follow rules, but we have to rely on ourselves, and then whatever we create is ours.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And so I did some things, like I got into tree climbing, like my PhD was this canopy, rainforest canopy research in the Caribbean, and I would spend, you know, long hours up in trees counting bugs and lizards and stuff by myself. And I'd learned to climb trees from this arborist. And I'd been a mountain climber, and I knew how to do ropes and knots and things like that. And then this tree climbing thing was amazing. He showed me the first day how you could go up one tree and traverse into the nearby tree and then come down. I thought, wow, that is so cool. So I was hanging around in the rainforest in Puerto Rico, and it would sometimes the rain would come by and I'd have to hunker down and protect my notes for a while. And I'd think, wow, you know, I'd really like just to traverse from tree to tree, like for a mile, and never come down to the ground, you know.
Like
and,
you're a monkey up there or something, huh?
Kind of like a monkey, yeah. Yeah. And I thought, you know, I bet it could be done. And so when I came back to grad school, you know, write my PhD up, I was going to Stanford. And there was a couple of other scientists, you know, young scientists, postdocs and grad students who were working with this big tree climber in, he was in Oregon then. And I said, you know, wow, I just had this great experience in Puerto Rico, and I want to go from tree to tree. And so they went up, these other scientists went up and met this, to climb with the scientists to do tree physiology, where they went up in the really tall trees to measure how the trees, you know, breathe and function and everything. And so they told Steve Sillett about me and said, hey, yeah, there's this grad student down at Stanford and he wants to go from tree to tree. So that's where Steve Sillett heard of it. So by within about like 10 years, Steve Sillett and I were climbing big trees in California. And he has become like if you've seen pictures of like snowy sequoias on the cover of National Geographic, mm-hmm. where they fall out,
oh, yeah.
that's him and his group. And so anyway, you know, he was a graduate student. I was just starting here at APU. And we got together and we started doing climbs, and we developed with another friend of his these things called magic missiles, which we could use to retrieve a line that we threw in a nearby tree. We'd shoot the magic missile with a crossbow, and the magic missile was like an arrow with recurved tines on it, and the tines would snag the line of a throw bag we threw over there, and then we'd reel it in with a fishing reel, and then we'd tie our climbing rope on that and pull it over. And then we could traverse from one tree to the next.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really crazy. So we ended up, I got a grant from National Geographic, and we went to, you know, Borneo and Australia and did the sequoias and the redwoods this way, traversing from tree to tree. And that was really neat, but it was something like nobody really ever heard of.
Which was part of what makes it so cool, right?
Right, but I wasn't really doing it like, hey, look, I got a feather in my cap. I was doing it mostly because it just seemed...
It seemed awesome, yeah,
right.
And it was.
Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm talking with Roman Dial today. We're taking an hour to explore Roman's life and work, and he has much more than an hour worth of stories to tell, but really want to hear as many of them as we can. This thing about the wilderness races was a big part of your life, and these were these races where you sort of just pick two places and then you got these hard-ass guys and women who just are going to go between the two places however they do it. It's up to them. Nobody's going to be watching out for them, making sure they're okay. And then whoever comes out at the other end is the winner. And I'm curious as to how that came into existence and how it evolved, you know, and what was the kind of what made you want to do that in the first place?
That's a great question. that's another... I guess that's another example of something where the idea was sort of floating around somehow, and a bunch of us sort of came up with it at the same time, and then we met each other, you know. And so I was, I guess I was 20 years old, and I was climbing in the Alaska Range with Carl Tobin and this guy Ron Piers, and we tried this mountain, the north face of 9448, which is a real pointy peak, kind of like the top of Mount Deborah, but lower. And you can see it real clearly from Fairbanks on the skyline there. And Carl and I had climbed another mountain the year before called 10910. And after we climbed 10910, we skied out. It was a great ski out down the Susitna and Black Rapids Glacier to the Richardson Highway. And then we tried 9448 and we failed, and we were just going to sit around in the tent till the airplane came to pick us up. And I was like, hey, let's just ski out. And these guys, they didn't want to ski out. They just wanted to stay there. And so I decided to go out on my own. And I didn't have a map. I didn't have a tent.
I wonder why they didn't want to do it.
Well, they had the map and they had
the
a
map
tent.
And
yeah,
tent. Okay.
But it's real easy to find the way because you just keep the Alaska Range on your right and all the flats on your left and just stay. You don't really need a map, you know. And it was about 55 miles, and I did it in about 55 hours. And I got to the road and I thought, wow, this is about the same distance as it was from 10910 out. I wonder, you know, what's faster, the glacier route or the tundra route? And that route from the Richardson Highway to the Parks Highway across the Alaska Range, what they call the Hayes Range, is kind of a classic ski route, the Black Rapids, Susitna, West Fork, Yannert Glacier, or a traverse along the north side, which is glacier free. And I thought, wow, what's the faster way, you know? And maybe we should have a race. And so that was like in March, I came up with that idea. And yeah, and the idea was to have a race and you'd take everything with you. You know, it wouldn't be like, you know, I mean, we didn't even have any multi-day races at the time. There were no multi, I mean, the what was big was the Ironman. You know, in Hawaii, which is a one-day race, but had a marathon and a couple-mile swim and a 100-mile bike.
Like destroying your body rather than covering different terrain.
Right. Yeah. And so, I was in October. I was at the Wood Center on the UAF campus, and there was an Alaska Mountain and Wilderness Guides Association meeting with people, you know, like the Aconecs and Gary Bocard and, you know, the Fairbanks guides who take people to the Brooks Range, and that was going on, and I didn't get to go. I've never been a guide, and I was just a punk kid, climber kid, you know. And but right outside the kind of conference room where they were having this meeting, there was a flyer, and it said the Alaska Mountain Wilderness Classic, you know, a point-to-point race from Hope to Homer. I was like, what are the rules? And it was like, carry all your own stuff. I was like, wow, this is exactly what
I
want to
do. Yeah.
And this guy, George Ripley, came out and kind of saw me reading the flyer and came over to talk to me. And I'm like, hey, is this a ski race? He's like, it could be a ski race. You could ski across the Harding Ice Field, but this is a summertime race, but you can go any way you want. And I said, well, I've got an idea for a race. And he said, well, kid, you know, why don't you come down and do my race and then we'll do yours. So I went down, and that was the first Hope to Homer. And that was a great race for me because I learned about pack rafting from Dick Griffith.
And that was when he sort of like introduced everybody to it, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
he was getting across what?
Skelack River.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was a glacial river. And I was with this Dave Manzer, who lives here in town. And Manzer and I had sort of teamed up because we both crossed the Resurrection Pass trail about the same time. And so we teamed up because we were nervous about swimming rivers and things like that. And that's what we were supposed to do, is swim like three rivers to get to Homer. You know, there was the Skelack, there was the Kili River, and then there would be the Tustamina River. And that's when Dick showed us
the pack raft.
Oh, very dangerous. Yeah, no, we didn't have dry suits or PFDs. We just had backpacks and rain gear, you know. And the backpacks, this was back in the day when your backpack, a light backpack, had a leather bottom, you know, and made out of Cordura. Anyway, we ended up traveling with George Ripley for a while, and he introduced me to animal trails. I'd never really known that was a thing, you know, like moose trails, because I was a climber and a skier. I wasn't down in the lowlands. And then Manzer taught me like how to make a fire and to bring a cook pot and start a fire with a candle. And so that was really like eye-opening. So that was a really good experience. And I liked the whole idea of going fast and light. And I did that race for a couple of years.
And you get to the river and you see Dick get across it with his little raft and everybody else is struggling.
Yeah, that was eye-opening. Yeah, I mean, that was like a slap in the face. So of course the next year I had a pack raft, and then once you know, we used pack rafts and I used them, I thought, wow, you could do a lot with these. And then that was just another example of sort of like somebody showed something to me, and then my brain sort of like exploded with ideas.
And so did you win that race?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of that's like,
and that put your name on the map, I imagine.
I guess it did. Yeah. You know, because nobody had ever heard of something like that, even though like it was an Alaskan event, you know. But it kind of captured people's imagination.
Yeah.
And then I was the race organizer for a few years, and I also came up with the Wilderness Ski Classic, the Winter Ski Classic, and put that together for a couple of years. And then, you know, I left to go to graduate school and wasn't involved in organizing them anymore. But I kind of stepped in and out of the race thing. And it has been a huge part of my life, because it's the people who I you know, I really appreciate people who've done the race, and then we do trips together, and all the things that we've learned. We don't have to race, but the things that we've learned during those races, like how little you need to carry, and how uncomfortable you can be and not really be uncomfortable, I guess. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but
just like you're still okay. It's
right.
Just like no big deal, just ignore it.
Well, I guess like if you go if you live in your house and then you go camping on the road, you're like, wow, I'm really roughing it.
Yeah.
Compared to being at home. But then if you go backpacking, you go, wow, car camping's pretty comfortable. And then if you like go on a wilderness camping trip off trail, you're like, wow, backpacking on trail is really comfortable and easy. Well, if you do like a wilderness classic, when you come back to like just a regular old wilderness trip, it's like, wow, this is really easy and fun. So it's just a contrasting event that you learn, you know, like, you know, I can make a fire when it's really wet. I can hike with wet feet all day long. I can find an animal trail when I need to. I can take my wet socks off and put dry socks on, and I sleep really well. Yep. So it's just, it was a really good learning experience.
But when you're out there on one of these classics and you're just, you know, beating the crud out of yourself, and you've been at it for a really long time, and you're wet, and all these things are happening, I mean, that doesn't sound very fun, right? I mean, that's something that's, you may still want to do it, but it's kind of a different thing than like having a pleasant hike down the trail and looking at the flowers.
Right, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm Carl Tobin, you know, he used to say, well, it doesn't have to be fun. Uh-huh. And that's true. And now there's this whole, you know, type 1, type 2, type 3 fun sort of thing. But I guess...
What's that? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, like type 1 fun is fun when you're doing it and fun when you talk about it later. Mm-hmm. And type 2 fun isn't fun when you're doing it, but it's fun to talk about later. And type 3 fun is never fun. So I guess that... For me, though, a lot of what I got was my philosophy came from, you know, from Dick and from Dave Manzer, in that it was bad style to suffer. You know, like you should really
shut up about it. Yeah.
Well, not so much that don't complain, just don't put yourself into a suffering situation. Mm-hmm. I did those eco challenge races for many years, and I saw people in those who thought that was what they were supposed to do. They thought, wow, I'm suffering. That's what this is supposed to be about, is suffering. And my feeling is that if you're suffering, then maybe you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. You should try to not suffer. And so for me, the Wilderness Classics were a lot about putting yourself in situations that would be very uncomfortable, but how can you figure out how to make them most comfortable? Mm-hmm. Because really, you know, we're humans, and it wasn't that long ago that humans were wild creatures too, and they lived in sort of discomfort. Mm-hmm. But they weren't stupidly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So the idea was to be creative and intelligent about, like, how can you be most comfortable, especially in the Wilderness Classics, where, you know, I didn't want to destroy my body. You know, I didn't want to be, mm-hmm. like, I wanted to be, I mean, I really admired Manzer after the end of, you know, one of the Hope to Homers, and the third one, and then he, you know, he went for like a 15-mile run the next day. You know, mm-hmm. to me, that was really impressive.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer, I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm talking with Roman Dial, who's an APU professor and has had an amazing life of adventure in Alaska and done lots of things that very few of us will ever do. One of the things that I'm thinking about, Roman, is along with this thing about like you shouldn't suffer to suffer, which I makes all the sense in the world. The other thing is, and I feel like you would agree with this, although we've never discussed it, is just because you went out and did this, you're not a hero, right? You did it because you wanted to. You weren't saving somebody's life, right? And when you talk about it, you're not, you know, you're just telling us about it. You're not bragging. You don't necessarily want to bring up how many races you won. It's sort of like part of the aesthetic of it is, yeah, that was your thing. You did it. It's not about being a hero, having a monument put up for you and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I suffer from a little narcissism. I'd be the first to admit it. And, uh-huh. And I like to get the credit where the credit is due, but I also, you know, acknowledge that I'm definitely not a hero, and I've never thought that any of this stuff was heroic. You know, I think heroic is sort of when you when you risk yourself to help someone else. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've had to help other people a few times, mm-hmm. but I've never, yeah, I don't know, I kind of do it for personal reasons, but I have thought, you know, wow, like if I race, I want to beat people. Like, I got out of the Wilderness Classic for a while, and then this guy Rocky Reifenstuhl started doing them with his brother, and they were like really worthy opponents or rivals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were great competitors. Like, they were, you wanted to beat them because they were so good, and they were kind of obnoxious about it. And so I always kind of thought the Wilderness Classic was sort of like my race, and I was, even though I didn't even do it anymore, but they got in and were winning them. And so that kind of drew me back in. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was a, I wouldn't say I was being heroic by any means, but I was definitely being competitive.
You know,
there's no doubt about it. I am competitive.
And part of that drive is what got you out there in the first place.
Right, yeah. And so I do, you know, I do like to, I did like to race a lot. You know, I raced
in all And then it evolved into something you're doing on TV, which seems so totally different. But tell me about how getting into sort of this, like, sort of these big world races and this sort of thing where you're, media is part of it.
Right. Well, that's a great question. What happened? I was out of racing, but some of these other people that I'd raced with who'd come from the lower 48 or raced against had come up to do the Wilderness Classic. They were still in the ultra running community. They were active in that. And the Raid Galois and the Eco Challenge came on the scene. And so Adrian contacted me and said, hey, I'm putting together this Eco Challenge team. And I'd seen it out in the periphery. You know, I was like, wow, yeah. You know, there's the same idea as the Wilderness Classic is going big time now. Mm-hmm. It was on TV. And so I guess that when I saw that, I was like,
I can do that.
Right. And when I was invited to a team, you know, I wouldn't have put together my own team because it cost $15,000 for an entry fee. And
oh, wow.
You had to have a team and all this gear. And I, you know, I just didn't, you know, I had other things I was interested in at the time. And but when I was invited, I thought, sure, you know, because this is kind of, I'd like to do this. So I went down to the second Eco Challenge. It was in British Columbia. And that year, I'd mountain biked from the Canadian border to Lake Clark. It was like 800 miles or 700 miles. And we'd ridden our mountain bikes on animal trails and glaciers and gravel bars. And I was in good shape.
And this is before the wide tires, right?
Right, yeah, these were just 26-inch mountain bikes with like an inch and a half front suspension. And yes, we had the widest rims you could find, and they were, you know, like an inch, you know,
right.
They were tiny. But it was an amazing trip. It was an awesome trip. It took us, I don't know, a couple months. And so I went down to this race, and I was in good shape. You know, I had this big bushy beard, and it was a team race where we had five of us. I only knew one person, that was Adrian, who I'd raced against in the Wilderness Classic a decade before, really. And we did well because it was in British Columbia. It was brushy, and we had to go over rivers, you know, glacial rivers, and we had to go over ice caps and things like that. So it was just like Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 75 teams, and only three teams finished the entire course because it was a challenging route and the weather got bad. And if you didn't have a lot of experience with that kind of thing, you would go slow.
Yeah.
And then the weather came in and you got shut down and you couldn't go across the ice cap, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, you know, had some experience, you could move more quickly.
Of which you must have had it more than anyone. Yeah.
Well, I had more than most of the people mm-hmm. there, you know, and because I'd just done this big bike trip.
Mm-hmm.
And there was bicycling involved, and there was horseback riding involved, and there was climbing involved.
And this was all televised.
It was all televised, yeah. I think it was on, I'm not sure, maybe Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came in second place, and we could have won, but I got bad. Mark Burnett put the race on. You know, he was sort of like the father of American reality TV mm-hmm. that went big. I mean, there had been other reality TV shows, and I didn't even have a TV. Like, I hadn't, once I left home, you know, when I was 16, you know, I was proud of the fact that I didn't have a TV for, you know, until our kids were like in third and fourth grade. And
suddenly you're a TV star.
Well, I wasn't, you know, but I didn't intend to be. I just wanted to do well in the race.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
But they always pick out the character, right? And here's the Alaskan wild man. Yeah, I'm sure you were a character for them to focus on.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I was blunt in anything I wanted to say, and I thought a lot of what they did in the race was stupid, and I made it clear that's what I thought. And because, you know, the Wilderness Classic is pure. You know, I mean, there's no television, there's mm-hmm. no checkpoints, and to me, like, everything that they thought was such a badass activity in their Eco Challenge was like, you know, you should come to Alaska. That's where we're really doing stuff.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it kind of scratched the narcissistic urge that I have.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I did well. And then, and it was easy to get on other teams and it was easy to get money and do more races.
What was the media impact on it though? Did that introduce a BS quality to the thing with the sort of the media and the televised aspect? I remember you telling me about like doing one of these trips with a group of Playboy bunnies or something, you know, and some of the stuff that sounds on the bogus side.
Yeah, it's very bogus. In fact, I never wanted to watch any of the shows because mm-hmm. every time I'd watch one of the shows, I'd be like, I don't remember, that wasn't the race I did. Mm-hmm. And so to me, what reality TV is, and I don't like being part of reality TV. Reality TV is not reality at all. And basically reality TV is taking a bunch of stuff that they filmed live as it happened and then rearranging it into a story, into a near fictional story.
It's not true. Yeah,
it's not true. And so so I never really liked watching a documentary. Documents what happens, and when you watch it, you're like, wow, that's it, that's what happened, you know. Mm-hmm. And it documents things as it happens. In reality TV, it's not reality, and it's fictional.
Yeah.
And so I didn't, I loved doing those races. They were really well organized. They had like these incredible ropes courses, you mm-hmm. know, like they, one was in Patagonia and they had these fixed ropes over all these granite spires down by Bariloche. And you just kind of scrambled along on the rocks, clipped into these fixed ropes, and it was amazing. Or the British Columbia race, they had these traverses over these gigantic crevasses. And I would never rig a traverse across a gigantic crevasse where you're like sliding along the rope and
yeah.
you know, 150 feet down and 100 feet across. It was like amazing. Or in Australia, rappelling down these cliffs to these next to waterfalls into these gigantic plunge pools
that you had
to swim across and then, you know, get onto a rope and jumar out and then rappel down to the next one. You know, it was just crazy. Like,
and so it's an opportunity to do something you'd never get to do otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, yeah. like, you know, you ride your, you know, like you do this bush trek through the Australian mm-hmm. outback and then you come to your box that you've packed with your food and dry clothes and then you change your clothes and you get on a bicycle and ride your bicycle for a day and a half, you know, mm-hmm. nonstop. And then you get off the bicycle and they've got sea kayaks lined out. It's like Chris Flowers said, he went to the Australia one and he said, wow, this is like the best vacation I've ever been on.
Yeah.
You know, because we had, you know, this outback canoeing, we had these really neat rappels, we did horseback, we did whitewater rafting, you know, did all this wild trekking.
And you're getting paid, right?
Well, you know,
or at least if you win, you get something. Huh?
You get something if you win, and yeah, I mean, eventually, you know, I got out of that stuff too, and mm-hmm. then people lured me back, and I said, "Well, I'll go if you pay me,"
mm-hmm.
But I never did it for the money.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to Roman Dial today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Roman is, as you're hearing, a world adventurer, and he's also a professor at APU here in Anchorage. Roman, I want to talk about your son and his disappearance. Cody was in Costa Rica, right, and he was kind of following your footsteps and doing some solo, fairly challenging stuff in the backcountry, and then just you stopped hearing from him.
Right. Well,
this was about 2 years ago?
Yeah, it's longer than that, 2014.
Okay.
So yeah, our our son, he, like my wife, like Peggy, I introduced him to the outdoors
mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to do stuff with him, you know, and so I... like when he was 6 years old, just the two of us, we went out to that third Aleutian Island. So it's Unimak and then Unalaska and then Umnak.
Mm-hmm.
And it was back when Mark Air, you could get those dividend
mm-hmm, right.
and tickets. And I thought, wow, I've always wanted to go to the Aleutians. Here I can go for cheap. I flew to Dutch Harbor and then somehow I got a plane that he and I got on. He sat on my lap. And
he's just a little one, huh?
6 years old, yeah.
Wow.
And I carried all of our stuff. And so we walked from Fort Glenn, this old military base, to Nikolsky, which is an Aleut village on the other end of the island, like 60 miles. And I picked Umnak because it has a geyser basin.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he would kind of be tickled to see hot springs uh-huh. and geysers. And so we did the trip, and it was really marvelous.
And he was into it at 6.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're with your dad, like, you're always happy, right?
Maybe, yeah, 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 exactly. Like, I mean, we have, you know, sons have a thing for their fathers.
I mean,
you can be a really horrible father,
yeah,
and your son will still love you.
Yep.
And so, but I tried to be really gentle with him. I tried, mm-hmm. you know, I read Charlotte's Web to him every night.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Charlotte's Web, yeah, and you know, I dressed him well. Like back in those days, I took photos for the Patagonia catalog kind mm-hmm. of on a regular basis, And so they would ship us clothes so we could put them on our kids and take pictures of them. So I always had, I could keep them warm and dry and happy.
Mm-hmm.
So so anyway, after that, it kind of was like a watershed. And so every year, you know, he and I would do some sort of major trip, and he was like a pack raft pioneer. So anyway, you know, I mean, he and I did stuff like, you know, right up till the year that he disappeared. In 2014, he was traveling in Mexico.
And how old was he at that point?
27, I think. Mm-hmm. Yep, he turned 27 in 2014. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we went and met in Veracruz, Mexico, where there's this great whitewater kayaking, whitewater rivers. And I brought him a pack raft, and we met up with a bunch of friends, and we all pack rafted these great whitewater rivers and stayed at this kind of camp and things, and it was fantastic. And then he continued on south, and he had kind of put his graduate studies on hold. He'd gotten to a point with his own research with the biogeography, if you will, of these kind of crustaceans that live in the Arctic and also in Europe, a genetic analysis mm-hmm. of those and the geography of their genetics. And, you know, he'd done some really remarkable work, but he, you know, it was time to write it, and he was kind of struggling with writing it, and the results weren't as clean as he wanted. It was just his master's project, mm-hmm. and he kind of treated it like a PhD. And so he took a break from his studies, and he'd made some money, so he took off, went back east, visited college friends, went on a bike tour, and a bourbon bike tour through Kentucky. And
sounds like he was having a good life.
He was having a good time, and then he went to Mexico, we met, uh-huh. and then he kept traveling south, and he would send emails like on a regular basis, you know, mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, I've been traveling around Guatemala and I'm climbing volcanoes in Guatemala, and I've decided that it's just too easy to look it up on the internet or get a guidebook or talk to people in English. So I've decided that I'm just going to start with the volcano's name, and then I'm only going to get directions from locals in Spanish.
Like father, like son.
Well, I guess so. You know, yeah. The one difference is that he was doing a lot of his trips solo, is mm-hmm. what we thought. And I don't really like doing solo trips. You know, I've done some, like I do maybe one every few years, but I don't really like it. I like people. I mean, maybe mm-hmm. it seems like I've got a kind of a prickly personality, and maybe I don't like people, but I really do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's why, you know, I've worked hard to be sure that Peggy enjoys and is competent in the outdoors.
Right, right.
You know, because we've been doing stuff
so
together.
So you got somebody to go with, right?
Right. It's so much more fun to share it. Like,
of course.
If it's beautiful, like, mm-hmm. wow. Or if it's miserable, let's make it better.
But Cody's young. He's sort of like trying things out, huh?
Yeah. And he needs to sort of show that to himself. And he had done trips on his own, you know, up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So he was doing that, and Peggy wrote him an email like, hey, are you like meeting people or anything? He's like, oh yeah, definitely. I'm taking other people out to do stuff, but most people are kind of afraid to do anything that's not in the guidebook or you don't have a guide. And he was like, I really don't like having guides because it's not as adventuresome, mm-hmm. you know? It costs money and they just lead you around where everybody else goes.
Yeah.
And he wrote me all this. So anyway, he stayed in touch with us. He did some really remarkable adventures. He walked across the Petén, which is the biggest wilderness area pretty much in all of Central America, north of the Darien Gap. He soloed across that and wrote a big story about it and sent it to us. And then he went to Belize, and he went to Honduras and went down the Patuca, Rio Patuca, which is a really gnarly cocaine-ridden traffic area. But he wanted to go because Honduras otherwise it was kind of sketchy. Mm-hmm. And this was the Mosquito Coast area, which is Indians and natives, as opposed to Latins, where all the crime was. And, you know, he went down this boat in a series of dugout canoes.
Wow, what an adventure.
It was quite the adventure. And he did it with this Canadian guy that he'd mm-hmm. met and talked into doing it. He wanted to pack raft down or buy his own canoe, but he couldn't find one. All they could uh-huh. find were sit-on-top kayaks. So these are all emails that he'd sent, and he described what this whole trip was like. And he came out, and then he went to Nicaragua and he went surfing for a while. And then he said, hey, I'm going to Costa Rica. Where did we go when we went, Dad? Because he and I had gone down there with an APU class that I taught when he was like 11 or 12. So I said, here's where we went. And then he wrote and said, hey, I'm going to Corcovado, but they changed the rules. I'm leaving tomorrow, but they changed the rules. And I didn't really read the full email because we'd been talking about maps, and I went on a trip myself out to the Talkeetnas, and I came back and there were like, you know, 100 emails, and I was sort of looking through them, and here was this one that said, hey, I found the best map yet. And I thought, oh, he's still talking about maps. I didn't bother to read it. Then Peggy and I went dip netting, and we came back. We hadn't heard from him for a while, and I went to look at the emails, and what did he really say? And I went and I looked, and he's like, he'd said, hey, I'm going in tomorrow. I found the best map yet, and I'm going in tomorrow, and here's my route. Uh-huh. And I should be out in about 5 days. And so I was quite used to hearing from him saying, here's where I'm going to go. Like when he went to the Petén.
He's giving you a flight plan.
Yeah, when he went to the Petén, he said, here's where I'm going to go. And I was like, no, you're not going to do that. I looked on the internet, and I looked at Google Earth, and I was like, that's like 120 miles, and you're going to walk across that by yourself in a wilderness of jungle. It's all flat. No, you don't do that. You know, that's dangerous. Yeah. I wrote this email, but I didn't send it. I couldn't bring myself to send it. Like that's the kind of thing I didn't want to have to deal with my whole life is, hey, I got this idea.
Yeah, and somebody tell you like, not to do it. Right?
Exactly. I'm like, God, this is what I kind of want him to be able to do. So I never sent those emails. I wrote, hey, well, be careful with your machete and watch out for snakes. And, you know, and I know you'll have a good time.
Yeah.
And so he did it, and he came back and did. He had a great time and learned a lot and didn't have any misadventures on it. So anyway, I was used to him telling us, here's where we're going, here's where I'm going, and then saying, hey, I'm out.
Right, because that's the basic safety, yeah.
It's the basic safety, yeah. And it's the basic safety, and you and I know that, and we Alaskans know that. But outside, it's sort of like, what? You know, like, no, the government's responsible for taking care of you or finding you if you're in trouble, you know? And you should be filing your route plan with, you know, the government or whoever the land manager is. And so anyway, you know, we haven't heard from him because we were used to hearing from him, and we're not, we haven't got an email like, hey, you know, what's going on? And so I looked back through the emails, and here was an email that I finally read in detail, and I was like, why didn't I read this earlier? And he was like, you know, 10 days overdue. So then, you know, I pretty much left the next day with this good friend of mine, Ty Verzoni, and we went down and started looking for him.
Yeah, down in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm talking with Roman Dial. So this story of Roman's sad, tragic story of your son's disappearance, and you look for him for a long time. You thought perhaps he had come to foul play with the drug smugglers or whatever else is going on down there, and then having failed to find him for a long time and having really worked at it for a long time, you turned to TV again, right? I mean, that became an opportunity. Tell us about how that all came out.
Well, you know, I spent 6 weeks down there looking for him, and there was this one story just kept coming back about this guy Patalora who guided Cody, but Cody, his name was Roman. After UMNAC, when we were on UMNAC, when we walked across UMNAC, when we started this trip at Fort Glenn, this guy said, "Hey, little boy," you know, we went through the introductions when the plane landed us at Fort Glenn, and there was a family that lived at Fort Glenn. And this family was this old Bronco buck rider named Gene and his wife and his 30-year-old son. And Gene's like, well, you know, what are you doing here and who are you? And I said, oh, I'm Roman Dial. I kind of hoped he'd heard of the Wilderness Classic and was like, oh, hey, cool. What are you going to do? But instead he was like, you know, why are you here? Yeah. What are you planning? What are you going to hike around? I'm like, sort of. I'm going to walk to Nikolski. He's like, that's 60 miles away. And you're going to do that with how old's your little boy? You know, and I'm like, 6. And he's like, hi, little boy, what's your name? And he goes, I'm Roman too. And so he'd been Cody. His middle name was Roman. And so ever after that, he would always introduce himself as Roman. And so when I was in Costa Rica and I was looking for him, anybody who said, oh yeah, I saw Cody, I knew that they were either wrong or lying because he never went by Cody. He always went by Roman.
Interesting.
And so, and I'd put a flyer, I'd sent information down there and it said, you know, Cody Roman Dial is missing. So I spelled out his whole name. But in Costa Rica, Cody would be his first name, and then Roman would be his last name.
Surname.
And then Dial would be another surname. And so when I went down and I was Roman, they just thought that it was Cody and his Roman part was me, you know, or was my surname. So they didn't really. So whenever anybody said, you know, oh yeah, I saw Cody and this guy Patalora, who was like a ne'er-do-well drug dealer, who claimed to have walked with Cody across from, you know, one side of the Osa Peninsula, which is where Corcovado is, to the other, I was like, no, it wasn't the same gringo, because number one, he'd been in Central America for 6 months. He'd walked across the Petén, boated down the Patuca, for example, which are like two hard. I mean, he was training for the Darien Gap, to cross the Darien Gap. And so, you know, it would be kind of like, you know, Vern Tejas. You know who he is, right?
It'd be
like Vern Tejas, like going to the East Coast and hiring somebody to take him up Mount Washington on the tour, on that road that goes up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, no, you know. And my son had already complained about this fact that he needed guides, and he was sneaking into the park because he didn't want a guide. And Corcovado required guides. And he said, yeah, just since February, Dad, they require guides. And I'm going in alone without a guide. So for this drug dealer to be walking him on the mule trail, which wasn't even in the park.
Not believable.
Yeah. And so, but it was a story that wouldn't go away. But there was another guy that I met who'd been a miner, and he'd been in the park illegally, and he'd been in this very remote section where their only trails were kind of these poacher and miner trails that are very subtle. And he said he and his buddies were there walking up to go to their illegal mine, and they came upon this gringo, and they were shocked to see him in the jungle there. And the gringo was sitting there just cooking on a stove. And this miner described the stove as kind of like tall and like nothing they have around there. So it reminded me of the jet boil that I'd given to Roman as a Christmas gift a few years before. Mm-hmm. And this guy said he talked to him, and he said that this young man said he was from Alaska, and he said his name was Roman. Mm. And so then I'm like, yep. So this was sort of like a litmus test that I used.
Yeah.
Did you run into my son or not? Well, you know, what was his name? Mm-hmm. So anyway, what happened is, you know, I spent 6 weeks down there. This Patalora story wouldn't go away, but I ran into these miners, and then I did several trips, both legal and illegal, into the park looking for him. Couldn't find him. Went back in December, went down to Panama to the Darien Gap in case he'd been there, and went into the Darien, and not far, just a little bit, and nobody had seen anybody like that. And so it put me back, and Peggy and I had done the route that Roman had said he was going to do. We hiked it with a guide that we hired. He wasn't really a guide. He's like a 60-year-old poacher kind mm-hmm. of guy, and who really knew it well. And Peggy's like, you know, he's not here where we're looking. I think something foul play must have happened. And so mm-hmm. I was like, yep, I think you're probably right. Let's look at the foul play angle, because nothing else is happening. But I know it wasn't Patalora. So anyway, you asked about the television. We kept getting bugged by television. Hey, we want to do a TV show. And I would, like, I know what TV is like, you know? And I never even answered those emails. But somehow somebody got hold of Peggy and said, hey, you know, my father was murdered in Honduras. And I tried to find out who his murderer was for 10 years. And the only way I was able to do it was by bringing a camera down there. And people opened up. And then I got, you know, the guy who murdered my father into jail. Hmm. And so we think that we can really help you find your son by bringing television.
This was a come on from the producer of the show.
Right. Yeah. And Peggy was like, I think this guy's sincere.
Try whatever you can try at that point, right?
Exactly. Yep, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you're going to try whatever you can try. Yeah, I mean, this is your son. You know?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, what else are you going to do? And it was consuming us, you know, like this is all like, I mean, I worked hard to kind of distract myself. I got stuff done, but I mean, it was always in the back of my mind, and every free moment, you know, we'd mm-hmm. go back to Costa Rica. So the television people, we Skyped with them. And what I really wanted was I wanted some sort of like a private investigator. We had hired a private investigator,
right.
Costa Rican, but I wanted another gringo guy who could, like, you know, push buttons and mm-hmm. get names and, you know, find out what was going on. So they got this DEA guy who just retired, and he was a drug enforcement agent for like 25 years in Central America. So he spoke Spanish, he was scary looking, you know, and I thought, this is the guy. And then they also got a PJ who I knew, and we all here in Alaska know who the PJs
are. Parajumper.
Mm-hmm. And this guy was a parajumper based out of Florida, but he'd come up and done this Armed Forces Eco Challenge that I had organized. And he'd been on the winning team. And I really respect the PJs. You know, they're mm-hmm. like,
absolutely.
Awesome. And he and I knew each other. And I was super happy to have him part of this. And so the original plan was that he and I would continue searching in the jungle while the DEA guy, you know, Carson, would poke around in the towns, because he just wears flip-flops and shorts and he never goes into the jungle. Well, I had some other experience with television doing some sort of like documentary tree climbing things mm-hmm. in Borneo and South America and places like that. And I realized they were really good at getting permits to go into parks.
Right, because so everybody loves TV, right?
Right, and I thought, oh, they're going to get our permits. I'm going to have free access mm-hmm. to the park and go search and do what I want. Well, they couldn't get permission.
Really?
And they never were able to let us in the park. And so the whole show just shifted into this, you know, Carson Ulrich chasing down Patalora's story, you know.
Which was BS.
It was BS. And Patalora said, oh, yeah, I walked with Cody. And his story always changed. And
so the TV thing turned into a really negative experience in that sense.
Right. And, you know, like, so so anyway, he was really convinced that Patalora's story was right. He was pissed off at me because I didn't, like, give him a big hug for trying to help me out. And the reason I was like, thank you. You know, thank you very much. You know, you're my consultant. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
on the wrong track.
Yeah.
So when this whole TV thing was done, and it's about to go on the air, then you find out the truth, which is it's just an accident that could happen to anybody in the outdoors, right? As a tree fell down.
Right, yeah, and so they, you know, the father of one of the miners who had seen Roman in the jungle, the community had kind of pushed him to go look a little harder.
Yeah.
Because I'd put up a reward. There's a lot of other details in here, yeah, but I put up this reward to kind of flush out who we thought may have murdered him. But the TV show loved to get, and this is what I really hold against them, is, you know, they had Carson Orlick say, and they got this all on film, oh yeah, so here's what happened, Roman, this is really hard for me to tell you, but your son was abducted by miners, and then they killed him, and they cut him up and fed him to the sharks. You know, and I'm like, oh no, and this is like, all I'm thinking is, he's gone down the Patalora story,
yeah,
route. And so, and I was really upset with this, and the TV catches me upset. Plus it's, you know, just thinking, visualizing your son.
Of course.
So the horrible combination of like something that I knew wasn't true, but still was a horrible,
yeah,
vision. And then this guy that I was hoping would do what I couldn't do was going in the complete wrong way. And then the cameras, you know, in the heat of Costa,
yeah,
Rica, it just really irritated me that that's what they wanted.
And it's really manipulative and exploitive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the worst possible way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but, you know, so, yeah, I suffered.
What you signed up for, I guess.
Yeah, and, but I didn't know that. They said, I asked him, is it going to be a documentary?
You thought it was going to be legit. Yeah.
I thought it was going to be a documentary show. They told me it was going to be a documentary,
yeah,
show, and it turned into reality TV, which is,
yeah,
kind of neither.
Which,
right?
in something that is so heartbreaking and tragic, for them to manipulate and exploit that is just revolting.
So then they made these trailers, and they said, oh, hey, Roman, you probably shouldn't watch the trailers. And they were horrible. They were like, you know, recreations of a bloody machete dripping blood.
Oh, my God.
And this, you know, young man running through a creek, and these guys with their machetes raised chasing him. This is on National Geographic television, you know. And so anyway, those trailers came out and freaked out this little community.
Yeah.
Because this little community is trying to kind of raise itself up by the bootstraps and become a tourist destination because it's right on the border of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this horrible, nobody's going to want to go to this community because people,
yeah,
will chase you down with bloody machetes. So they sent this miner out who was, you know, really savvy. And he found bones and found a pack and immediately took pictures of it, got to, like in the jungle, there's little places, they're like telephone booths where you can get a cell connection, you know, and they all know, the jungle guys all know where those are. And so he sent out 911 immediately. And I happened to be that day at the FBI in Washington, D.C., where I was trying to get the FBI to keep pushing. And I had this really elaborate and amazing story that I kind of cobbled together based on kind of Carson. And there were some very bad guys on this other side,
yeah,
of the peninsula. But anyway, yeah, it turned out that that probably soon after the miners had seen Roman, he'd made camp because it was only like half a kilometer away from where they'd seen him, and a rotten tree had fallen. And if you spend any time in the rainforest, you find out that trees fall a lot, especially in the rain. They're like avalanches.
Yeah.
You know, like the way avalanches come when it snows, well, trees fall when it rains, except you can't like dig a pit for tree fall.
Yeah.
And there's no courses.
And this is part of being safety. Doing these kinds of adventures. I mean, you're out there and bad things happen that sometimes are not your fault.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. It's really, really difficult and it'll never be easy, I know.
Well, it's better than
not knowing.
Yeah. It's,
yeah,
better than not knowing. It's far better than having him murdered. And then,
yeah,
then your whole life just becomes swallowed up in hate over somebody,
yeah,
who did something,
yeah,
horrible.
Right. Well, thank you, Roman. It's been fascinating. And I know that our listeners' hearts go out to you and to your wife and your family over what happened. And you're writing a book about it, and I'm sure that'll be an amazing read, and I'm sure you have a lot of great adventures ahead of you as well.
Thanks, Charles.
Right. My guest has been Roman Dial, Professor of Biology and Mathematics at APU. It's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.